south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
I've been traveling a lot lately, been to a couple of high-end resorts, medium and low-end resorts, too. They can be fun and amusing for a while, a couple of days. Wouldn't want to make a habit of it, though. But, you know, in the act of going there and mingling with the people, I have learned a few things that you would probably never learn if you didn't speak enough Spanish to have the locals break into a normal conversation with you. I'm talking about Spanish speakers now. If you live in Latin America and don't speak Spanish, you don't know half of what's going on. That's one of the cool things about learning Spanish enough so that you can have any kind of conversation with whomever. Funny thing, though, when I'm at one of those high-end resorts in a Latin American country, oftentimes, Latinos with dough, that is, those who could afford those resorts, will come up to me and start conversing, in English, of course. Now, it's not my doing, but as crass as this sounds, upscale Latinos are unapologetic, unrepentant, extreme gringo wannabes, and their kids are, of course, too. Man, it seems to happen every time I'm at an upscale resort or a fancy restaurant. I get approached by some obviously wealthy gringo wannabe. They'll start speaking to me in English because they don't think I know any Spanish. They don't think any gringos know Spanish. Why would they? Most of us don't. And, of course, at high-end resorts, you get lots of high-end Latinos, people with money, who've sent their kids to private bilingual helicopter schools. Their kids live in a bubble, generally. Normally, wealthy Latino parents speak some English because they go back and forth to the States. Because that's what well-heeled Latin Americans do. They have to put on the dog for everyone else in the gated, guarded community they live in, so they program a couple of trips a year to go shopping in Miami or visiting the relatives in Nueva York or Nueva Jersey, or just plain hang out in Disney World. Yep, that's right, Disney World. The true magic mecca, if there ever was one, of each and every Latin American. And it's never a secret. They always have to let their friends and neighbors know about it because that's the point of putting on the dog. That's the real point of going to the States, going shopping in Miami or Disney World. I know you longtime listeners have heard me talk about that stuff before. So what's the point? Well, because, you know, when wealthy Latina starts speaking to me in English, oftentimes I'll break into Spanish because it's a little easier for them. And they'll be pleasantly surprised enough to let down their guard and start talking about normal, everyday things. Things they wouldn't say to a person in English, but they will in Spanish because that's their native language. And, well, let me just set up this example. You know, many more than a handful of times I've heard Latinos, that is, well-heeled Latinos who can afford those high-end resorts, they'll tell me how lucky I am to be a gringo. Actually, most high-end Latinos won't use the word gringo. They'll say, you're so lucky to be an Americano. Americano. American. It turns out the more educated a Latino is, the less he'll use that word gringo, at least in mixed company. Anyway, as mentioned, I've been told many times by Latinos, I'm lucky to have been born a gringo. And I suppose that's true, but hey, it's the luck of the draw when you're born, right? Now, of course, to keep the conversation rolling, I'll often say, why? Why am I so lucky to be a gringo? Tell me. I know, there's 101 correct answers to that question. Of course, lately, my answer to that kind of question isn't what it used to be. In the old days, I might have said something like, yeah, I know, I won the geographic lottery. But you sort of did too in your own way. I mean, look, we're both here at this high-end resort. We're maybe part of the 5% of the world that can afford such a thing. So why are you complaining? After all, what's that old saying? Comparison is the killer of joy or happiness, something like that. And that's when sometimes the upscale Latin American I'm talking to throws in a little dig. Like I said, that's happened to me more than a handful of times. The guy will say something like, yeah, you're right. We're part of that 1 or 5% of the world that can afford such things. But if you've noticed, it's always better to be a gringo. Then I'd say, tell me more. They'd tell me all right, something like this. Just notice the way the help caters to gringos versus the way they cater to us upscale Latinos. When you gringos sit down at a table, the waiters go over and serve you first. We could have sat down 10 minutes ago and still they'll go serve the gringos first. So in effect, what many upscale Latinos are getting at is their correct but unfair observation of the gringo advantage. Now, your regular, lower class, middle class, or common Latinos will never bring that stuff up to you. They don't think of that as a negative thing. It's not even on their radar. Though I've noticed some upscale Latinos, like I said, especially at high-end resorts, have a sort of a chip on their shoulder about how most all Latin Americans treat us gringos. They don't like the fact that the gringo advantage exists, yet they themselves are extreme gringo wannabes. How does that wash? Now, I'm not saying that when I'm in discussions like that with Latinos, they're getting all fired up about it. They're not. It's just the occasional offhand comment. But you can tell, well, I can tell anyway, it does slightly irritate some of the more snobbish ones. After all, there are some very rich Latinos who could buy and sell the average gringo 100 times over. Yet the gringo would get consistently better service in restaurants, resorts, government offices, banks, you name it. You longtime listeners have heard me tell many examples of that fact. Things like that happen all the time to myself, gringo friends, gringo acquaintances. Most commonly, for example, at the immigration office, you walk in, you suddenly see there's a huge line. You're probably going to stand there for an hour and a half. Then, by some miracle, within a couple of minutes, someone walks over, takes your arm, and brings you right to the front of the line. That's happened to me many times. Now, if that was to happen in the U.S., people would get really pissed off. That's why it wouldn't happen. And let me tell you, when you first start noticing that happening to you down here, you will sneak a peek over your shoulder to see if there are any mean faces staring you down. And guess what? You won't see any. They'll all be smiling like, go ahead, gringo, go. As if it were the natural order of things. And you and I know it's not. And believe me, it's ongoing. There's no shortage of the gringo advantage, especially when you're well off the gringo tourist trail. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago at the El Salvador International Airport, when I walked into the big immigration room to go through the passport stamping process and all that, there must have been 50 Latinos standing in line in front of me. I was the only gringo. Tallest guy in the room, too. Guess what? One of the uniformed immigration guys lifted up the guard rope in that maze area. You know, you have to walk through a maze to finally get to the counter. He let me skip right to the very front of the line. Now, I'm not saying that happens all the time. It doesn't. But you do see the gringo advantage, gringo favoritism, everywhere you go. And, as mentioned, it seems to rub upscale Latinos the wrong way. When they have mentioned it to me, like, for example, that gringos get better service than Latinos at the same restaurant, I'm often able to shut that conversation down completely with one simple retort. These days, when a Latino says something like, you know, you're lucky to be a gringo. Well, sometimes if I'm being testy, I'll say, it's not because we're gringos or that we're white. It's because we tip better. Period. Punto final, as they say in Espanol. I notice that line of thought shuts the conversation down in a hurry. It's funny, too, to realize that down here in Latin America, to be white and to be gringo, in other words, a white American male, is to be king of the mountain, again, by pure luck. Unlike up in the States where the media and the wokesters have turned against us, basically we're non-entities, if not personas non grata. Yeah, that's right. In our own country, where Latinos always say we were damn lucky to be born. Of course, for me, all that talk about persona non grata in your own country is only hearsay because I live permanently down here in Latin America. But man, let me tell you, I'm certainly getting an earful from my friends and relatives up there. And of course, the internet's just loaded with anti-white male hate. Which brings us to this email from Xavier, originally from New York City, now living 4 years, he says, in Argentina, and happily married to a beautiful Argentine lady, a 10, he says. Well, good for you, Javier. By the way, Xavier in English is Javier in Espanol. By the way, Javi, we'll have to take your word for it that your wife's a 10. You didn't send any proof. I'm seeing no AI-enhanced filtered photos here. Maybe next time, huh? I'm always curious as to what a 10 is in one guy's eyes versus another. Anyway, he says, Dear Johnny, it's funny how you don't notice how entrenched you are in your specific culture or nationality until you travel to another country and live there a while. I get it now when you say people who consider themselves, for example, middle class in the UK, the United Kingdom, would be considered lower middle class by US standards. I know what you mean. I lived in the UK for 3 years, back in around 2001 through 2004. Same thing goes for how people who call themselves middle class in Latin America would be considered trailer trash or poor in the US. That's why you can never believe the statistics you read coming from the first world media about poor, middle class, poverty levels, etc., etc. Since the so-called poverty level here in Argentina, where I live, means a person living on less than $10 a day. Whereas if you look it up, the poverty level in the U.S. is a person who's living on less than 50 bucks a day. The whole thing just doesn't make sense, and I can see why people worldwide are confused when it comes to stated poverty levels. You see, if an Argentine was living at U.S. poverty levels of 50 bucks a day, he'd be considered pretty well off. He'd be in the upper 20% of income earners. Anyhow, Johnny, like I said before, you never notice your own social class until you enter another one, like when you move to a different country. For example, no Latin American I've ever met, and I speak Spanish pretty good, including college kids here in Argentina and college graduates, none can tell me what heteronormative or cisgender means, or any of the other new terms for sexual proclivities that were sort of invented the last couple of years. What a relief. I think I need to repeat this, Johnny. No Latin American I've ever met, including college kids and college graduates, can tell me what heteronormative or cisgender means. But on the other hand, any first world college-aged gringo or gringa tourist I meet down here can precisely explain those terms to me. People won't believe this, but when a college-aged U.S. tourist talks to a local Latino here about how their governments, their Latino governments, need to defund the police, support BLM and open borders, and permit a certain amount of looting, and use terms like social justice and white privilege, what generally happens is that Latinos within earshot don't get at all what these people are talking about, and in fact think that young American gringo tourists are from another planet, or that they're just making some kind of crazy statement for effect. The fact is, Johnny, I mingle mostly with 30, 40, and 50-something Argentines, none of whom know what the word woke means. Of course, none of them have been to the U.S., but they have a certain idea of what the U.S. is all about. They got their ideas from older U.S. TV reruns on cable. Programs like The Simpsons, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Friends, Seinfeld, etc. I'd say most 30, 40, and 50-something Argentinos have an idea of the U.S. that they got from TV programs when wokeness had not yet infected the brains of American writers in Hollywood. Anyway, Johnny, all I can say is thank God for lag time. Signed, Xavier living the good life in Argentina. All right, thanks for that, Javier. You know, he made a couple of very interesting points there. One, maybe not so obvious, but I get it. You see, as wokeness slowly spreads to Latin America, thank God not too quickly because of lag time, it first tends to spread with the college kids. And of course, adolescents who are addicted to their smartphones. The woke mind virus spreads slowly southward, first across the Rio Grande, obviously to Mexico first, and then slowly working its way down, and finally, thankfully in a very watered down and diluted form, to places like Chile and Argentina. You know, it's easy to see why wokeism is so diluted once it gets to South America. It's because very few South Americans ever make it to the United States. It's way too far, too expensive. You did know it's an 8 to 10 hour flight from the States, right? Think of it this way. Mexicans are in and out of the States all the time, as are Guatemalans, Panamanians, Salvadoreños, Cubans, and now, of course, Venezuelans. And as they travel back and forth and occasionally get deported back and forth, they're exposed over and over again to U.S. wokeness. It rubs off like shit stains on your shoes in a dog park. That's why it's logical to believe a country like Paraguay or Argentina or Chile will be some of the last to fall to toxic wokeism. And as of now, thank God, Latin Americans are just not buying it. Meanwhile, up in the States, elite liberal white people and second-generation Latino college students certainly are. This, according to a young Puerto Rican intellectual living in the United States, he went to Columbia College, a guy named Coleman Hughes, who just wrote a scathing book about it. Just listen to what he says about the word Latinx, a word that no one here in Latin America ever uses. A term, though, that elites in American colleges and universities have fallen in love with. He said that when he started going to Columbia University, he started hearing the word Latinx. It was a first for him, a Puerto Rican. He'd never heard it before. People would use it in conversation, and he'd say, "What? What are you talking about?" He was confused. He said, not only do real Latino people, you know, his family, friends, and such, never use that word. He says it doesn't even phonetically make sense by the rules of Spanish grammar. He said it completely violates all the Spanish gender rules, too. For one thing, he never even heard that word Latinx outside of the walls of Columbia University. No one on the street or in everyday commerce ever uses it. Meanwhile, he says you've got major politicians from the Democratic Party using it all the time in their rhetoric. Most all of them non-Latinos, like Elizabeth Warren and so forth. Referring to Latinos and Latinas as the Latinx community. A word that 3 years ago you couldn't find in any dictionary. He said in a brand new Gallup poll taken on the streets of Latin communities, people were asked if they liked to use that term Latinx, and 60% of them didn't even know what it meant. They never heard it before. 36% had heard the term and did not like it and would not use it. And only 4% of the Latin American community said they liked it and would use it. That 4% consisting almost entirely of second and third generation Latino college students who'd picked up that word on campus or from the Latinx insert in the Los Angeles Times newspaper. A weekly insert, by the way, that almost no regular middle-class Latin Americans ever read. Anyway, that's a pretty good measure of the U.S. Latin American cultural elite. They're living in their own kind of culturally exclusive woke bubble. They're the ones setting the new woke standards and making woke rules for the other 96% of the working-class Latinos in America. The maids, the gardeners, the blue-collar workers they have nothing in common with and never will. Do you think that for 1 minute, second or third generation Latinos going to universities or colleges hang out with Latino maids and gardeners and non-English speakers? Nope, no way. In fact, second and third generation Latinos in the U.S. who are college graduates seem often to be embarrassed of their own poor and middle-class relatives, the ones who made the initial sacrifice to come to the U.S. and start anew, the ones that worked so hard as maids, gardeners, and grunt workers. Many second and third generation Latin American college graduates are embarrassed of their own parents and grandparents. I've seen it in action, too, when they come down to visit the motherland, the home country, the way they put on the dog for the poor relatives back home. Funny thing, too, after they've shown their relatives how successful and relatively wealthy they are, playing king for a day or a week or a weekend, I've noticed they'd rather have a conversation with me, a gringo they've never met before, than hang too long at the resort with their own blood relatives. And if you think this is hyperbole, a couple of weeks ago at my Expat Insider Seminar, I was talking to one of my bilingual seminar ladies. She said, Johnny, you're so right. Quite a lot of Latinos who slip into or immigrate to the States, some of them who've done pretty good, let it go to their heads. She said they've got this thing about coming back down to the home country to show off and brag about their success with the poor folks back home. She says, you know, that is a real problem. I know quite a few people like that. She said that phenomena is common enough that the locals have coined a term for it. Now, this lady seminar helper is a Guatemalan. So she says Guatemalans who come back to the homeland to put on the dog are called, get this, gringo malans. Gringo malans, not Guatemalans. Gringo malans. Again, they're basically Latinos up in the States who've made a bit of a success and want to shove it in the faces of the relatively poor folks and family members back home. Worse yet, she says, they don't even want to speak Spanish to the folks back home. And even though, she says, their English sort of sucks, they prefer to use their shitty English, as bad as it is, to prove they've been living up in the first world. All of that is done, of course, to impress the folks back home. She said it's sort of pathetic and it does wear on you. Though the folks back home tolerate it, they do zip their lips. After all, their Americanized visitors are bearing gifts. They always bring gifts to show how well they're doing. All that does, of course, is perpetuate the idea of the sueño americano, the American dream. No wonder the locals call them gringo malins. By the way, in Costa Rica, they're called gringo ricans. In El Salvador, gringo doreños. You get the picture. In any event, when the conquering hero comes back to the homeland on vacation to do some bragging and put on the dog, the locals do zip their lips. That is, until he's left the room. That's when the eyes roll and the daggers come out. After all, nobody likes a smarty pants. All right, moving on. Now an email from an Expat Insider Seminar repeat offender, Jen. She says, Dear Johnny, hope all is well. I have a question, though. How should a homeowner protect solar panels from things like hail? Below, I've enclosed a photo of a solar panel setup destroyed by a recent hailstorm. She says, if you noticed, a single hailstorm in Damon, Texas destroyed thousands of acres of solar panels. Which leads to the question, is it really wise to make ourselves dependent on expensive energy infrastructure that can be rendered permanently useless by a bout of bad weather? Well, thanks for that, Jen. Very good question. Glad you brought it up, because I have some other information about solar panels that could be of great interest to anyone trying to get off the grid. First of all, Jen, you have to remember, only in northern climates are you going to get those really big hail balls. In fact, I remember practically every spring and fall when I was living in Chicago, there'd be a couple of hailstorms. The hail balls ranging from very tiny, smaller than a Tic Tac, to marble size, which very infrequently damaged some cars. I think only once, I remember, a neighbor actually filing an insurance claim because a hailstorm wrecked his paint job. Now, as far as solar panels, here's the story. In my case, down here in Central America, I've had solar panels for at least 10 years now. And only twice in the Altiplano do I remember any hail. Small stuff, though. Now, don't think that solar panel companies aren't well aware of that eventuality. By the way, the three states that get the most hailstorm damage claims based on insurance company stats are Texas, Colorado, and Nebraska, with Illinois coming in fourth. Now, we're not talking about damage claims for wrecked solar panels, because that's sort of a new thing, and I believe you have to get a separate rider on your homeowner's insurance policy, because most of them don't specifically have that written out in the contract. Another thing you have to know is high-quality solar panels, the expensive ones, are very resistant to hail damage. It's the old you-get-what-you-pay-for thing, just like the show. Turns out all well-made solar panels are protected by a thick layer of tempered glass, and all tempered glass has a safety rating, by the way. You're never supposed to walk on your solar panels, but I've seen videos of people doing it. Even half-ass installers, and yet the panels don't break. Though it's a terrible idea because you could put micro cracks in the glass and then reduce the output power and functionality. By the way, most people don't know this, but if you do crack a panel with a rock or a foot or hail, 99% of the time you'll still be able to use that panel. It'll still put out power. Though it may compromise full power a bit, you could check that out with a voltmeter at high noon. So, if you get a cracked or damaged panel, I certainly wouldn't run out and get it replaced right away. By the way, my suggestion is to always buy a couple extra solar panels so that it puts out 5 or 10% more than the amount of rated wattage solar input that your inverter will maximally accept. Let's say your inverter takes 10,000 watts, maximum. Now, with my last solar setup, I bought a couple extra panels so that it put out 12,000 watts at high noon. Now, you might think that's 2,000 watts of wasted energy because the inverter would only take 10,000 maximum, right? That's true. That also means I have some reserve there. If my panels get dirty or cloudy or cracked, chances are for much of the day they'll put out way over 10,000 watts, and that's all my inverter can handle anyway. By the way, that's a lot of solar power. About 30 individual 400-watt panels. Oh, and another thing, not all external cracks on solar panels will result in reduced performance. In some cases, the damage is solely cosmetic and only on the surface. So then looking down on those panels, a crack or two may be ugly. But then again, who would know that? Except maybe the birds and the alphabet agencies. So bottom line, there is a way to tell if your solar panels could take a couple of big whacks from hailstorms. Turns out the good folks at Underwriters Laboratories, you know, UL, provide hail impact tests and insurance certification under the code UL61730. That's the rating, UL61730. Let me read some of the certifications for you. It says solar panels with the UL61730 rating, that's in the U.S., or internationally with the IEC61730 markings, are resilient to most hailstorms across the U.S. and the world. Turns out solar panels that do pass these ratings can withstand 1 to 3 inch hailstone storms, with stones traveling at 16 to 88 miles an hour. Now, I don't know about you. I've seen a 1-inch hailstone, but never have I seen a 2- or 3-inch one. And I've seen a dozen or so hailstorms. A 3-inch stone is bigger than a golf ball. By the way, studies show that the natural range of speed or velocity for hail is between 10 and 75 miles an hour. So as long as they meet that UL rating, they're guaranteed not to crack or break. Now, of course, if there's some real black swan hail event, 4- or 5-inch balls of hail at 100 miles an hour, let's say, not a single window in your house is going to survive. And think about the driveway, chickens, man. At that point, worrying about your solar panels will not be a priority. By the way, if you go on the internet, you can look up which solar panels meet or exceed those UL ratings. In other words, unless you're living in the hail belt up there in the States, I wouldn't worry. Speaking of solar panels, you may have heard that flat solar panels require regular cleaning. You know, getting up there and actually watering them down and cleaning them off, or having your maintenance guy do it anyway. Well, the good news is if your solar panels are angled at 10 degrees or more from the horizontal, you almost never have to physically get up there and clean them. Maybe once or twice a year. If maybe you've got some stubborn leaves jammed into the corners or some heavy bird crap spots. That's always a possibility. The good news is that if you live up in the States, you're always going to have your panels tilted at more than 10 degrees, so you won't have to worry much. However, down here in Latin America, I see lots of solar panel installation mistakes because you don't have to angle them at all. You can lay them flat because the sun's rays are almost perpendicular to the earth. But man, I'll tell you, if you have them flat or near flat to the horizontal, you're asking for big dust, leave, and buildup trouble. In other words, flat solar panels get flat out dirty. And as the dirt builds up on them, it gets caked down harder and harder. Then, of course, more and more difficult to remove. With flat or near-flat solar panels, there will come a time when just hosing them down just won't do the trick anymore. The problem is there a heavy, solid layer of dirt will almost always build up concentrated on the lower edges of the panels, working its way into the corners and edges. Think about this. Leaves and pine needles have sap in them when they're laying on a flat surface in pools of water created by, you know, humidity and rain. You can get some real sticky gummy areas on those solar panels. Very hard to clean up. By the way, if you have solar panels on your roof, you should invest in a cheap drone. That might set you back only $100 or $200. Or who knows, maybe you like toying around with drones, you get an expensive one then. That way, after every couple months or so or big storm, you can inspect those panels without having to climb up there. By the way, don't forget to leave a good amount of space under your solar panels so you can get in there and remove leaves and pigeon nests. I've seen way too many panel installations that are too close to the rooftop, leaving no way to get a brush or a broom under there to clean things out. Because, you know, leaves and branches and dust and certain critters will collect there. All right, enough said about that. Let me leave you with a message from Clifton, an Australian who has a nice big solar setup, he says. He's working on his plan B, wants to retire and not do a single thing anymore, he says. He says, Johnny, every job I take on in life, I underestimated it, and it took me way too long. He says, I have discovered there are only two things that are way too short. Life and penises.
South of the border, you've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.